Welcome to Theodisc, the WTC Theology Podcast. I'm your host, Kenny Innes, and if you've never checked WTC out, then I'd recommend visiting our website, wtctheology.org.uk. We make part-time, university-validated theological study accessible to the whole church. That means you. And once you've done that, then you can pop back over here and carry on listening to this episode with Dr. Amy Brown Hughes. I'll be talking with Amy about a topic that has often been left for youth groups to discuss nervously. That's the topic of virginity. In her work in historical theology, Amy has explored the ways that, for the church, virginity has historically been about more than just sexual abstinence, but was a calling, an identification with Christ and the church, and a theological category in its own right. We'll talk about the ways perceptions of celibacy and marriage have changed, and how we might learn from the early church to reclaim the virtues of chastity, faithfulness, and integrity in our personhood. Amy teaches patristics at WTC and is an associate professor of theology at Gordon College. She holds a BA in theology and historical studies from Oral Roberts University, a master's in general history of Christianity, and a PhD in historical theology with an emphasis in early Christianity, both from Wheaton College. She's the author, with Lynn Kohick, of Christian Women in the Patristic World. Her research interests include Eastern Christianity, Trinitarian and Christological thought, Christian asceticism, theological anthropology, and highlighting the contributions of minority voices to theology, especially those of women. She's also a co-host for the theology stream of the Biblical Studies and Theology podcast, On Script. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Amy. Amy Brown Hughes, it's wonderful to have you on the Theodisc podcast. Thanks for being here.
I'm so happy to be here.
It's been a while. I've been trying to get you on, and finally,
I'm here. I am the unicorn that you have been hunting for. Here I am.
Listen, just go ahead and build it up right from the beginning. That's great. That's So we are going to have a conversation today about a topic that people sometimes feel a little bit odd talking about, but we're going to talk a bit about virginity and kind of a theological approach to virginity, how we can understand it and perhaps in some ways reclaim it as a way that our faith is embodied. But before we get to that, we have to ask you three questions so we get to know you a little bit more. This is for first time guests only, so next time you come on, you don't have to do this.
Not important for me to be known the second time, just the first time.
Exactly.
Also, I love how you gave that whole introduction and they're like, we're not going to talk about that yet.
We're teasing.
Teaser. Okay, I love the teaser.
We're teasing. That's right. So three categories. These are things that you return to. So a book that you return to, a food or a meal that you return to, and a location, a place that you return to. So let's go for a book first.
Jane Eyre. I have read that one multiple times. I don't know what it is about that story, but that's a particular one that I've returned to. It's a little bit more maudlin than Jane Austen. There's something about it. It's a little darker.
Yeah.
And something about that I am drawn to regularly.
Cool.
Yeah.
What about a food or a meal?
Food or a meal. I would say that there's a particular little Italian restaurant, kind of hole in the wall, in Salem, where I live in Massachusetts. And it's just a really sort of simple pasta dish there. It's not super fancy, but I just associate it with kind of celebration and time with family. And I don't know if it probably makes it taste better, but also the place is just so small and little and vibrant. And I just kind of always think about that meal there as special.
Nice. The hole in the wall places are the best. That's it. And then a location or a place that you return to.
Yeah. So I'm originally from Colorado. So that's in the West, not the Midwest, the West in the United States. I grew up right in front of the Rocky Mountains. So I saw Pikes Peak, one of the sort of most classic mountains in the United States, out my window every morning.
Wow.
But for me, it's not there. There's actually some places up in the mountains that I don't ski. I grew up there and I've skied once and I hurt myself and I never went back. But I've been to those ski areas multiple times just to be in the mountains. And I particularly enjoy going during the summer when all the tourists from this, it's like a different, it's just a totally different vibe. Wildflowers everywhere, kind of just a little bit quieter than you find in the winter months. And there's just something about seeing these mountains when they're covered in flowers that just really, and the air is just very, it's thin, it's in the silence when you get up that high,
Yeah.
it's just quiet. And I just really appreciate that.
Wonderful. Oh, thank you. Great. Now we kind of have a little bit insight into your personality. So let's kind of turn to what we're going to talk about today. In our time, we kind of have this perception of virginity as being basically a point of moral formation, of a preparation for marriage. But it would be good if we could begin talking about the theologically deep and rich ways that the early church thought about and practiced virginity.
Yeah, I'm in the unique position as a historical theologian, and I'll just define that for people because I think that's not necessarily something you hear a lot. You hear theologian, systematician, you hear historian. So I'm in a situation where I straddle two different disciplines and basically can't make up my mind, and that's okay. But as a historical theologian, my job is to listen to the tradition well, and in our continuing dialogue that is theology. So basically, how does the early church, my particular field is the first few centuries of Christianity, how does the early church continue to help us, to help us, but and also just to be our companions as we journey together as the church, as the community of faith? So with that in mind, one of my major fields of study is to listen to them on how they've lived the Christian life. And one of the major ways that they did that was through a couple of different understandings of living a life of virginity, a consecrated virginity. And it kind of depended on the situation what that meant. So I think it's actually quite important at the outset to mention that what the early Christians called virginity is not what we talk about now.
Right.
In sort of modern Western frame, of course, this is, virginity is defined in kind of in general ways as someone who has not had a sexual experience or sexual encounter. That's sort of the general idea. And so it's not just Christians that talk about virginity, right? This is it's a concept that you see talked about in sitcoms. Like it's kind of all over the place. It's in, romance novels and books. There's kind of this like weird magical thing around it where coming of age books are kind of obsessed with talking about it. So there's kind of just, I would say that the early church was a little bit less weird in talking about it than we are,
Right.
which might come as a surprise. But for us, especially I think in kind of I'll speak kind of for the American structure, which has some very particular hangups when it comes to like virginity and what that is. In the US context, virginity is sort of like a state of being that is temporary and fraught, but also weirdly magical and also something that is a commodity. I would say it's commodified.
Right.
Whether it is something that someone has that then one loses, and then therefore you are now worth less
Right.
because you don't have it in some perspectives,
Mm-hmm.
or it's a commodity that someone else takes, because, being the first guy or whatever, that there's like a kind of there's a level of, I won't say honor because that's not the right word, but
Sure.
there's a level of accomplishment with this, right? So there's a commodification of virginity. And historically, you're going to see that in a variety of cultures, right? But particularly attached to marriage ceremonies, and particularly attached also to making sure that dynasties are keeping in the family, I would say, to make sure that this person getting married is not already pregnant or, you know, whatever, mm-hmm. In order to preserve lines, I'm thinking like in royalty and things like that. So there are different ways that virginity has been commodified. And in the early church, they are not thinking about it this way. They're just not. Virginity is associated with virtue. And living a life that looks like Christ. Virginity in the early church is connected. It's the continuation of martyrdom, which is probably not what you might have had on your bingo card. early on, you have Christians who in various ways are persecuted and who are executed. And when the early church no longer had the situation where they were being hunted down and killed after the Edict of Milan in 311, 312, under Constantine, then you have a situation where Christians still have the memory of persecution, where they are still trying to figure out what does it look like to have fellowship with Christ in his sufferings, to experience the power of the resurrection. And so another way that has been described is the long martyrdom. It's associated with Paul talking about how I die daily. So there's this understanding of virginity and asceticism, or largely the word asceticism meaning a life of discipline,
yep.
Where people, because of their commitment to Christ, see their acts of renunciation, renouncing, you know, sexual encounter, renouncing specific kinds of food, renouncing socioeconomic power and status as being a way that you don't just imitate Christ, but you live as Christ in the world. So virginity, you could be a virgin. And this is another way that it's different than modern days. You could be a consecrated virgin after having been married.
Right.
So, because there was a whole category of widowhood early on, and that kind of becomes swallowed up in the ascetic kind of consecrated virginal movement a little bit later. So it could be someone who has never had a sexual encounter, and those were consecrated virgins. It could also be someone like Melania the Younger, who was married to her husband Pinian, and they had children who both died in infancy. And then both of them decided as a couple to remain married, but to be consecrated virgins, like her. They didn't use that term for him. And living that life of asceticism together. So there were various different combinations of this, but it was also just more than abstention from sex. Also associated with this was the understanding that in imitation of Christ, in living into who Christ is, that you gave up everything. That meant, you know, the status that you had, you wore different clothes because the clothes that you wore indicated status, and that's not your family anymore. Yep. So this is why you see lots of descriptions about veiling of virgins, of wearing burlap, of wearing rough clothing. It wasn't because they were trying to like mortify their bodies and hurt themselves. It's because clothing equaled status. This is why many of them were vegetarians as well, because meat was associated with luxury. And we could have a whole fun conversation about that if you want.
Sure.
Being a Christian equals needing to be vegetarian. and there were a lot of other things that they abstained from. So sexual renunciation is one of them. But now we have that's sort of separated out as like its own special thing that we assume for a period of time in the Christian tradition prior to one's marriage. But the early Christians saw it as a vocation as opposed to a temporary status.
There's this representation of Christ in the world through this choice that's being made. What kind of status did they then have within the church structure?
Yeah, it sort of depended. There were either in the time frame, and also there were some distinctions between the Western Church and the Eastern Church.
Sure.
That distinction doesn't always help very much. The Eastern Church being kind of, physically East and also Greek speaking. And then you have the Western Church being sort of more physically West and Latin speaking. That binary doesn't always hold, but there is some distinction that we see here. In the West, there was much more of the vocation was, they were really concerned kind of about consecrated virgins remaining consecrated virgins.
Okay.
So throughout history, you're going to see a lot of conversation about like protecting them so that they represent the purity of the church. So later in the Catholic Reformation, after the Protestant Reformation, some like kind of before and after that, you're going to see a lot of concern around enclosure of virgins, where you're going to put bars on windows, like you can't leave the monasteries and the convents. And what's really funny to me about this is that Pope after Pope after Pope had to keep issuing orders of enclosure because these virgins would not stay in the convents. They just kept leaving. They kept going, and not because they were like leaving their lives, but they were going out and they were ministering to the poor and they were preaching and they were doing all this stuff. And they're like, no Pope's gonna tell me what to do. And they ended up having to put like locks on them, and they would even move entire convents like away from the populace so they could go over there and be holy over there where no one would come near them.
Right.
So some of it was a bit of containment. I would say that we have a containment narrative a little bit more in the West, which I do think that we are dealing with a little bit of the excesses of that even still now. Mm-hmm. In the early Christian East, you see, they were not as obsessed with that. There was a lot more kind of theological material around virginity, and thinking about Gregory of Nyssa's treatise on virginity, which is actually written to men. It's one of the few pieces that we have in Christian history about a life of virginity that is not written to women. But this is specifically written to men, and how virginity is a space where you live out the whole of all of the virtues come together in Christ, where you become like Christ, you embody the virtues in the world. They're establishing monasteries and also even being empresses. I think of Empress Pulcheria, who presided over the Council of Chalcedon in 451, in order to protect herself and her little brother when their father suddenly died. And her brother Theodosius II, I think was only 7 at the time, and she was 13. She declared herself a consecrated virgin. In other words, you can't marry me off. I'm staying right where I am.
Right.
And then she turned her whole palace into a monastery. Like, come at me, bro. And then like put her brother through emperor charm school for one. And basically to protect their family's dynasty and power. We have examples of consecrated virgins doing all sorts of things, but they were out in society. They weren't kind of the, what we might have is the stereotype of being in a church that you don't see them very much. They're kind of in their own convent. Not all virgins in the West are like that, but we have a stereotype that comes from that.
Sure.
In the East, they liked to build stuff. They were also patrons. A lot of these women had been married at some point and had a lot of money. And so they were funding Bible Bible work, like translation stuff, like I'm thinking of Jerome. Mm-hmm. And other translations of other works by Rufinus. I mean, there was a lot of patronage that consecrated virgins. Some of them were in their homes. Even in the West, we do have, prior to the sack of Rome, there were women like Paula, who was in her home and had created, so it wasn't a monastery, but her home was kind of her own space. And there was a significant amount of wealthy women who were there, who then kind of would have circles of women that they would influence. And those were extremely effective and really important for the theological development of the church. In my own work, I basically say without these women, these consecrated virgins in early Christianity, we don't have Trinitarian theology would not look like what it is now. Christology wouldn't look like what it is now. They are not peripheral to the development of theology. And what's interesting about that is that virginity has often, as a requirement, has often been a way to control specifically women's bodies, and to be coercive and to tell them this is how you need to be. And if you break this vow, then no one can get quite as bad as what the Romans did to the Vestal Virgins. I mean, they were buried alive.
Yeah.
Christians didn't do that. Thank God. But the punishment judgment on that and the and what happens when a virgin would kind of abandon her vows. That was a real problem. And the church really had to kind of process what to do with that. But the way that it's sort of viewed now, all of the weight that we put on teenagers and young adults in the Christian community, it's just not, it's not the same.
Let's pick up on that idea of enclosure. Mm-hmm. There's a shift here when the Reformation comes along about how that enclosure is viewed, because then we have this idea that marriage becomes the goal and virginity this temporary vow until marriage comes. So what effect did the Reformation have on that view?
So if you were a woman as an early Christian, the fourth century, you had two options open to you. You were married or you were not yet married. But the early Christians came along and said, what if you don't get married at all?
Right.
And you like spend all your time serving Jesus. The Romans were like, what? I mean, it freaked people out economically. It totally threw off like how inheritances were passed down. Like, what do you do with these women who now will never like leave home and go and marry another family? And then when we have, you know, that sort of gets translated through what we see with asceticism going into the West and monasteries and convents and nuns and all that sort of stuff. And when we get to the Protestant Reformation, Martin Luther has been seeing all of the abuses of that, and fair point. Mm-hmm. He's got a real fair point. And he sort of wants to say that being a monk or a nun is not the pinnacle of what it means to be a Christian. And basically, marriage isn't a secondary life choice. That was in the water of how one could actually be fully devoted, mm-hmm. that in order to do that, you had to take vows. And he was like, no, I don't think so. So in kind of recovering in a good way, that people who are married are not sort of subpar members of the church, that their prayers are heard by God just as much as others. I don't think he saw the consequences. He sort of jettisoned a possibility for singleness that was its own vocation in the church. Like, I get that maybe consecrated virginity was a bit much, mm-hmm. and like being enclosed as a monk or a nun, like that was, in his mind, that was prison. Like, we need to go set those women free.
Yeah.
But what the ramifications of that is that now in I would say Protestant tradition really struggles to figure out what to do with people who are not married.
Yeah.
Like, what is their vocation? Like, there's just sort of a sense that they're basically not fully able to be who they are unless they become married. So I do think that we lost something there. Even if what Luther was responding to was in many ways abusive, it has sort of brought us back to a binary.
So you begin with this idea of virginity as this highest of callings, this representing Christ, and then it ends up with a sense of incompleteness.
Yes.
And I think we still see the ramifications of that now in our church culture. So how do we reclaim this idea of virginity as vocation?
Probably not calling it virginity. I mean, there's just, you know, the baggage around that term.
Yeah.
But every human being is made fully in the image of God on their own. And there's some real messed up theology out there that says that you have to be married to another person in order, because you have half of the attributes of God and your significant other will have the other half of the attributes of God. Like, besides the fact that that is just the worst Trinitarian theology ever, no thank you,
yeah.
and just bad doctrine of God. It's also also really problematic in theological anthropology. Like, we are made in the image of God full stop on our own. We aren't walking around as incomplete halves. And so what does it look like for us to reclaim that we, as individuals, are made in the image of God? That doesn't mean that we can live an isolated life. Like, we do need to live a communal life, a life where the church of God is our family. But to kind of prioritize that, you know, we can get really obsessed with marriage now in many ways. There's a lot of the ways that we talk about it is kind of in like this fantasy that you can have. Like, I just think about how when I grew up in youth group, it was like this, marriage. So, and there's a whole like section of Christian romance novels. Don't even get me started on the fantasy stuff that surrounds that. Of what you kind of to expect in like a perfect Christian marriage sort of thing. And we haven't helped our young people or even adults really feel like on their own, they're made in the image of God. I mean, the fundamental relationship in the Christian church is not husband and wife, it's sibling, it's brother and sister. So I would really like to see, I actually think a way into this is a much more work on theologies around friendship, around different sort of formations of community, around what does it look like to embody virtue throughout your life as a part of community that isn't attached to gender stereotypes or gender roles. There's a whole conversation we could have about how gender roles intersect with that. We don't have time for probably. But the expectations around that, where starting from a sort of Galatian space of there's no Jew nor Greek, no slave nor free, no male nor female, and seeing the image of God as our basis, and then our relationship with one another. How then do we need one another? We need to talk about how we need one another, and we all image God, and we all image Christ and follow Christ and have the Spirit dwelling in us, making us more like Christ, embodying those virtues. And then, how do we do that together with one another that helps us to feel loved and like we belong, that we are desiring beings, that our bodies are not our enemies, our desires are not inherently evil? What does it look like to be more honest about what it looks like to have intimacy among the people of the body of Christ? I just think about some of the accusations that were thrown at the very early Christians. So they were accused of cannibalism because, you know, we eat the body and blood of our Savior. So of course, the early Christians were also accused of incest because of the sort of familial language they used with one another, which is not what they did as a society. So like calling one another brother and sister and giving each other kisses and all this sort of stuff seemed very sort of out of bounds and weirdly too familiar in that space. I just think about how isolated we are, how we struggle to show affection with one another without it being sexualized. I think of the damage in some spaces of in evangelicalism where men and women can't even have friendship without there being some issue there that we're deeply concerned about. Like every encounter has some kind of sexual overtone or undertone to it, where you can't even ride in a car together without the, you know, appearance of evil and all this sort of stuff. And so we have cast each other as being problems. And I really think that there needs to be a significant amount of recovery of a space of connection and affection and intimacy where we just assume that you know, maybe marriage isn't the only way to have a fulfilling life. Because I mean, the reality is not as many people are getting married. Some of that is because they're not finding someone, and some of that is because they don't want to. And then we have a whole slew of people who do get married and who then divorce for various reasons. So how are we presenting Christian discipleship in a way where people can bring themselves to it, where they can grow starting from where they are, as opposed to, oh, you missed the boat. Well, that stinks to be you. Like, you know, kind of to do the youth pastor, like, well, you're not a virgin anymore. So, you know, I remember, you know, being in youth group and passing that rose around.
Who wants the rose?
You took a rose and you took a petal
Yeah,
off.
yeah.
And then you got to the end, and the youth pastor would hold the empty flower and say, and this is what you give to your future spouse. Basically, you're trash. And oh man, this is not the narrative. And the early church would be like, what? What is happening? Yeah, that doesn't sound like virtue formation.
Yeah, and I think, you know, particularly the pressure is on, has been on young women, this pressure of being both attractive to men and also holding men off to preserve your virginity. And
A lot of work.
yeah, a lot of work, a lot of control that's involved there. And I do wonder, as we are recovering our views of women in the church, if a big part of that is also reforming the way that we see celibacy and virginity and the responsibility of both men and women to live up to the character of Christ and not just blame games or casting each other in, as you say, as the enemy or dangers to be avoided.
Yeah. What you just said.
I like that. The idea of virginity, however we want to call it these days, celibacy, is not just being something of abstinence and not just a temporary virtue, but actually something that's about purpose and about the value of people.
I don't know how much, you know, this would be helpful in the early church. So I'm going to get super nerdy for just a minute.
Mm-hmm.
So the word that was used for virginity is parthenia, Greek word. So that means that's virginity. But in the early church's understanding of what it meant to live a virginal life, which was like a theological category, there were several different terms, including that one. So parthenia was one of the terms, but there was also sophrosyne, which is the life of temperance or moderation. There was also enkrateia, which would be restraint, restraining one's desires for a period of time, for that would also be associated with perhaps with the practice of fasting, with the practice of other things. There was also hagneia, being the umbrella virtue. And that's the one that we translate now as chastity. Now, unfortunately, what has happened specifically in the U.S. with like sort of the whole True Love Waits movement in the 1990s,
yeah,
was that chastity got associated with virginity as the two things. And so you have it ceased to be a virtue and it became like, I don't know what it became. But chastity was understood as kind of having... it kind of dovetailed a little bit with harmonia, like having integrity and soundness of person. And it was really built on one's agency to choose to be virtuous. So chastity was this umbrella virtue that included these other things, but you could be chaste as a widow, you could be chaste as a young person, you could be chaste as a consecrated virgin, you could be chaste as a married person. And so then they understood that there were varying ways that people would participate or display the virtue of chastity. So, and Paul in 1 Corinthians 7, which one of the passages in scripture that gets interpreted the worst ever, poor Paul. 1 Corinthians 7, that's a whole thing where he talks about singleness and, you know, it's better to marry than to burn with passion and all that stuff.
Yep.
Really what we see is, it was a kind of a dynamic relationship with others and with oneself. So some people chose to live a life of restraint their entire life in a variety of different ways. I mean, John the Baptist would be an example of this. Like, he kind of had a life that was really marked by particular modes of restraint that was much more extreme than other people would do. And so there was not the expectation in, I would say, in the mainstream sort of Christian tradition spectrum of everyone having to be a virgin their whole life or something like that. But there was understood that there was restraint. And so when Paul says there are times where one restrains, that you come together, and then there are other times where you abstain, and this is for the good. Mm-hmm. Basically, we are not defined by our urges, and it's not just sexual urges, but it's also about our desires for ambition, for success, for food, for intimacy, for fulfillment, for just all sorts of different things, for sleep. I mean, it's just the very basic things.
Yeah.
We need to recover a sense of dynamic understanding of restraint with our own desires, recognizing them as fundamentally good, but also it's not always good to eat pie. It's like it's not a fundamental good to always have success at everything, to win at everything. It's not always good to take up space. Sometimes we need to give space for others. So we have to learn how to live with one another, and that means actually we practice restraint every single time we get in a car, I should hope. We practice abstinence when we have a surgery and we're not supposed to lift more than 5 pounds. So we're used to this. But the question is how do we recognize the capacity for each of us to seek discipleship that is flourishing, and also recognizes that following Christ is not a life of scarcity. It's not a life of unqualified, like, I can't do anything fun anymore.
Well, Amy, we've kind of come to the end of our time. I think I love that idea of chastity, of being those in a world that's just full of excesses and everything all the time, of how we live as a community who are faithfully exhibiting Christ in the way we deal with our urges, and turn that into love for one another, love for God, and love for the world that we inhabit. Thank you for spending the time, and hopefully you'll come back again in the future and we'll talk more. Appreciate you, Amy.
Oh, I would love to do so. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you, Amy and Kenny, for re-emphasizing how we as Christians have a responsibility to live our lives with purity as we witness to Christ in everything we do. It was great to see how the church through history viewed the concept of virginity and how we can view it in a healthy, meaningful way today. In our next episode, Kenny is joined by Murray Ray, and they will be exploring some of the themes of Murray's upcoming book, Resurrection and Renewal, Jesus and the Transformation of Creation. For those who may not know, Murray was Lucy Pepiat's PhD supervisor and is a world-renowned theological scholar, so definitely don't miss this episode. Thank you for listening to episode 35 of Theodisc. Join us for episode 36 with Professor Murray Ray as we look at resurrection and renewal. Bye for now.